Western philosophers and stuff about that life so much that it's passed down to the world to talk about. And then so much of the history we have is because
All right, welcome to another episode of the Joe and Doug Show. We are here in the studio. Joe is back from Florida.
It's
He's
not
got the
beach.
Orange shirt and it almost matches his tan.
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about.
And I drove 6 hours right from
Straight to be here.
Straight to be here.
You just wanted to be that badly back on the show.
I did. That delay, right? It was annoying. So
where did you go and what did you do? And we talked a little bit while you were in your beach chair and I was here. It was like 60 degrees here and 100 degrees there. Where'd you go? What'd you do?
Well, it was the Keys trip. So we went directly to the Keys, but we had some stopping points. I got the Space Coast and got to see, you know, all the stuff that's going on down there. I was hoping to catch a launch, but, you know, not in my favor.
All good. Well, we have a special guest back from Israel. He couldn't get enough, so he boomeranged back to Youngstown. Rabbi Pesach Wilicki, our friend, is back in the studio. You've been on quite a trip.
I have
been everywhere from Texas to Mississippi to Youngstown and headed off to South Dakota. What's your trip entailed? Has it been fun, hot, cold?
Well, it's been fun. It's been interesting. I mean, my trips are always interesting. You know, for those, can I assume that everyone remembers me from last time? So I live in Israel and I travel in the U.S. frequently and I visit Christian communities. I visit Jewish communities as well. But mostly I visit churches and Christian seminaries and, you know, try to build stronger friendship between Jews and Christians. So on this trip, I started out actually just with a private visit with someone who I had met a few trips ago. I stayed for a day and a half on a horse breeding ranch in hill country in the western part of Texas.
Good old country of Texas.
This was real. Like this is, if you know Texas at all, so like the cities in Texas are all actually bunched together, right? Dallas and Houston and San Antonio, it's like a little triangle where it's like 3 hours between them.
Okay.
Right.
I've never been to Texas.
Right. So that's the way it is. So it's like Houston's here and it's like a 3 hour drive or so between Dallas, Fort Worth and Houston. And it's like a 3 hour drive or so between Houston and San Antonio. And it's like maybe a 3.5 to 4 hour drive between San Antonio and Dallas. And Austin's right in the middle there between San Antonio and Dallas. And that's where they all are. Texas is a massive state, but the cities are kind of bunched together.
Okay.
And the western part of the state, out like towards El Paso, but not that far, once you get about an hour west of San Antonio, it turns into these rolling hills. If you've driven through, have you ever been to Kentucky?
Yeah.
Okay. So you know the way Kentucky's kind of hilly? Yeah. So it gets into these rolling hills and it's all ranches, a lot of cattle ranches and horse ranches. And the guy whose ranch I was staying at has become a very good friend of mine. And he breeds show horses that do reining, you know, like reining competitions. Uh-huh. And that's what he does. And it was really cool because I'm a real city person. I'm like, I've lived my whole life in cities. I am as urban as it gets. Even when I go on vacation, my wife and I are both city people. We like to go to cities, to see cities for vacation. Right. I'm like the opposite of, I like hiking like for a day. You know, and then going back home and sleeping in my bed. But I'm not used to being around animals. I'm not used to being in this situation. I'm not used to seeing the actual stars in the sky, you know, with no light pollution. So it was pretty cool. So I stayed out there for a night and hung out with him on this ranch I can't even say a town. It's not in a town. It was just like you drive and there's like some pinpoint on the Google Maps that he gave me. And there we were on his ranch.
Oh, wow.
And then I went to Louisiana, to Lake Charles, Louisiana, where I have a good friend who's pastor there. You know him, you know, yep. Todd, spent a couple days there. I spent a weekend there actually. Was hung out there for a few days in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And then I went up to Tupelo, Mississippi, birthplace of Elvis Presley. Birthplace of Elvis Presley, yeah. That's not why I went there. I went there because that's where the headquarters of American Family Radio is, big radio network. And they had invited me out there to be on a few shows and to meet their staff and did a few interviews, met some interesting people, and visited Elvis's birthplace, which includes a 1930s era outhouse as part of the display. I don't know if Elvis used the outhouse. I didn't.
It's still functional.
I did not know. But there was an outhouse there. I just have to note that. And then I went up to West Virginia, spoke in a church there. That was last night. And then I came out to Youngstown today. And then tomorrow morning, I'm off to South Dakota for a few days.
Nice.
So there's
traveling man.
Oh yeah. So yeah. So it's interesting. Like I live in Israel, but I really get to know America.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about getting to know America.
Okay.
We have not done a political show in a while. We did some stuff during COVID. We did some stuff during the election. And Joe and I tip our hands regularly in our normal conversation, but we haven't done just a raw, hey, this is where stuff is, because everything in terms of our country seems to revolve around politics, from the media to the culture. Like everything is hyper focused on what position did you take with this? Did you post a black square? Did you put your pronouns in your profile? Like everything,
even things that weren't political once long ago are political now. Everything's politics.
Shop here, shop
like you're wearing an orange shirt. That must mean something.
He outed me.
He's one of those.
And but
I'm not sure what those are, but yeah.
But as we have this conversation, it's fascinating because you know, Rabbi, obviously you're in Israel, and we're here in the States. I grew up in a blue state. You have grown up in Ohio, which is typically been a swing state, but it's far more red,
way more red
currently.
Yeah.
I think right now
it's hard to call Ohio a swing state. I think we could say that Ohio was a swing state.
Yeah.
Currently, the numbers, it's not a swing state, and it might not be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. I know that you've been very bold in our conversations, as well as even publicly, kind of your feelings towards American politics, and some of that is it affects Israel, but some of that is, you know, as America goes, the rest of the world goes, and so that's an important issue for you. So paint us from an Israeli perspective, from your perspective, and I understand you don't represent all Orthodox Jews, but from your perspective, what's the landscape currently of American politics as you see it?
Well, let's start with, you know, when you say like my perspective is it's hard to even call it an Israeli perspective because of the unique nature of my job. I mean, just, you know, just think about like what I do. I'm a rabbi who lives in Israel. I was raised in Canada. I'm a rabbi who lives in Israel. I'm an American citizen, though. I was born in the States, left as a baby. But I very much identify with America. But a lot of that has not to do with my upbringing or where I live, but with my work. So as you just heard, like a description of my trip, I take trips like this. I mean, before COVID and hopefully now afterwards, I take trips like this 8 or 9 times a year. And I'm all over the United States. So I think a lot of my political views have been greatly affected by my work, by my travel, by my relationships and really getting to know people. So I'm about where I am politically, and I don't like the terms right wing and left wing because what they traditionally mean, they don't really mean anymore. But I'm very much a populist, you know, America first, if you want to identify like what people call MAGA. Although it's not for me about Donald Trump. I don't find him the most attractive human being in terms of his personality, but in terms of his policies, like if you separate out who he is as a person. Like, I don't want him babysitting my kids. I have no desire to have dinner with him. I'm sure he might be. He might be a wonderful person, but like, it's not about the person. And this is an interesting point that there's a stereotype of people who are not Trump supporters have this stereotype of Trump supporters that it's a cult of personality.
Correct.
And
you can't stand his personality.
And you can't stand his personality. And I think, of course, in every political movement, there's a lot of people who are attracted to the personality. So an easy way to criticize any populist movement is to say, oh, it's a cult of personality because they're lionizing some leader. But from at least for me, and I think for a lot of people who are in that camp, it's actually about the policies.
Yeah.
And even a lot of people who are ardent, you know, populist, nationalist, America first Trump supporters actually have questions in their head about whether Donald Trump is actually the right guy.
Sure.
You know, so but I'm definitely in that camp. So I can't say that I was there. I was fully in that camp even a couple of years ago. I think if you go back a few years, I was probably more identified as kind of a mainline conservative, like a neocon, you know, Republican, you know, you know, that type of, but the events of the last couple of years have really pushed me into this place.
Well, and it's interesting because I think when I look at the landscape and I see people in different spheres in our church and our community, you obviously have the folks on the socialist left. You have few and far between, but you have the classical liberal, you know, people like Bill Maher, I'd put in that category.
Right, who are increasingly becoming politically homeless.
Yeah, super interesting when I find myself agreeing with Bill Maher, which is a rarity, but it is happening more and more. I'm like, I strangely, like with free speech stuff and different things where I'll come out and I'm like, I agree with Bill Maher. That's really weird. And then, you know, you have your middle of the road folks, your independents, your libertarians, and libertarians can go a little to the left or a little to the right. And then you have your conservative, you know, neocons, your rhinos and stuff that kind of fall into that wishy-washy middle ground. You have your MAGA and then you have your far right is kind of the way that I see the spectrum. And people find themselves kind of all along that branch. Now, I know from you that we've had lots of different conversations and you're like, I just want to blow up the system and start over because I know you and you're like, this thing sucks.
Well, what is different than blow up? We'll say that let's assign.
Yeah, this is going to get down now.
Let's assign duty based on ability to perform, right? And I don't think anybody is at a capacity that they're good enough.
Assign duty based on ability to perform. What do you mean by that sentence?
Okay, so if you're really good at solving a problem, then you get assigned the duty of providing the solution for that problem. If you're not good at that problem, so let's just say if you have a part of government that's supposed to make sure that poverty is taken care of and they're not any good at that, well, they shouldn't be given the duty of taking care of the impoverished because they don't have the ability to do that. So, you know, being libertarian, the smaller the government, the less reach that it has, less power that it has to, you know, force wills on people that it's not any good at. You know what I mean?
So how do those problems get solved in a libertarian system?
Well, gets to decide.
I think individuals have the ability to do stuff that now is being competed with by government, and you can't outcompete.
Yeah, but that doesn't work for everything. I mean, there's a lot of...
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, meaning those things where there is an entrepreneurial incentive will still get dealt with in that system, but there are going to be huge gaps where there are things that it's just not in anybody's self-interest to deal with, and libertarianism is not going to address it.
Well, it will say like the NASA program and being able to outsource someone who solves a problem bigger, and instead of the government making it their own thing,
have Elon Musk then, solve it, right?
Yeah, right. And you. So the government should be shopping more of that out from the private sector rather than trying to maintain it and become this big vacuum of power.
I'd agree with that. I would agree with that.
Yeah, I totally. And I know you being very pragmatic and like, hey, let's just find the best person to use and get the heck out of the way and let them do it.
Right.
But the problem, I think, is who gets to decide who gets to do that. And you're just saying, we'll just move everybody out of the way.
Well, the problem is that we give people the ability to try something, but it's indefinite. If we sunset these things and say, you got 6 months to solve this problem, we're just going to move on to the next dude. And it doesn't matter if you do it, you got a chance, you're on the stage, go. If not, it's going over here.
Yeah. So that's interesting because I never thought of that as libertarianism. Like you would call that libertarianism?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Removing it from the sole discretion of the government and keep spreading that power out.
Well, I mean, because it sounds like what you're describing is healthy public-private sector partnerships where things get outsourced, and there was a lot of that in Donald Trump's attitude to things. And the United States, the system of government in the United States is actually uniquely designed for that kind of diversification of the system. Where you have you have the federal government and then you have the state governments, and there's this constant tug of war between the state governments and the federal government about who has power over what, right? And then and giving more power to state governments, which from a raw libertarian perspective, it's still government's government, but it doesn't work that way because local government is always going to be more fit to solve their problems than a federal government is going to be. But it has the same kind of flavor to it where if the federal government is ceding power and giving more power to states the more localized decision making is, the more surgical it's going to be, the more economical it's going to be, the more efficient it's going to be.
Right.
Right. And
ultimately, the conversation that we have when we talk about government, though, is how much freedom versus how much security. How much do I have the ability to risk, whether that's in health insurance, whether that's in work, safety net, unemployment, all that kind of stuff. How much freedom do I have and how much security do I have?
You mean when you say I, you mean the individual citizen?
Yeah, the individual citizen, because the big argument with healthcare right now is healthcare is a human right, right? You hear that that mantra was big during the election. And it really boils down to how much personal responsibility and freedom do I have to take care of and own my own health? And then how much security do I get to have? How much do I get to know that I will have this taken care of and the finances and all of that stuff? There's a risk to that. And by and large, a lot of people are saying, well, it's just not worth the risk. It's an unfair advantage. And they make the argument of the insurance companies. I understand it's a complex, layered issue. But at the root of it is, how much personal freedom and responsibility do I have to own that, to own my business, to do what I want? And then how much security is there that someone's going to bail me out? I mean, that's every issue.
I think there's an issue where the sides, whether you call them liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, whatever you want to call them, actually end up switching sides. When you're talking about that. In other words, what you're saying is the more government control, the more regulation, the argument for that is greater security, and there's less openness for risk taking, right? But what happens when you have on the economic level? So the libertarian dream is there's no,
get out of the way.
It's total free trade, right? So if we have free trade, total free trade internationally, like little to no tariffs, and it's just, open trade. Well, that favors large corporations who can engage in international trade much more easily than smaller local manufacturers and local businesses. And those large multinational companies, because they're not there's no regulation, there's no tariffs, they can outsource the labor jobs to other countries where labor is very cheap. Mm-hmm. And that means that the American worker, the American blue collar worker is going to suffer. So open capitalism, as open as it can be, ends up actually harming the working class in America. So that's where everything suddenly switches sides. So arguing for more tariffs and for more regulations that incentivize companies to bring jobs back to America. This is basically the Donald Trump economic plan. This is what he was doing, the whole trade war with China. And that's what produces rising wages of the working class. But it comes with heavy regulations, from the government, which libertarians say they don't like, but it ends up empowering with wages and building up, building up the lower classes and building them up into a bigger middle class, and also preventing this kind of oligarchical rule of corporate elites.
Sure.
So this is what I meant before when I said that, left and right don't mean anything anymore. Is this a right wing position or a left wing position?
Right. Now, with those longer term things where, Trump would have given more time and been able to unwind some of those trade things. But we're in a system where we have such big pendulum swings, you don't ever have enough time for any of those things to ferret out completely. You have Obamacare that might have worked given enough time, but it couldn't have come to a success or a failure fast enough for us to decide it. So it's in this limbo. Same thing with the trade deals. We'll end up in that same space.
And maybe that's why every time a government comes in now, they move really fast. A criticism that you get from both sides, mm-hmm. as soon as there's a there's a change in power from one party to the other is you always have the losing side screaming, how are they pushing all these policies through so fast? They're rushing. And it's right now it's coming from the right, or whatever we call the right. It's coming from the, you know, from the Republicans, from the Trump base. They're screaming about how the Biden administration is moving so quickly, and they're moving so quickly on all their government spending and all these new programs. And they're moving so fast, so fast, so fast. Well, of course they're moving fast. Trump also moved fast.
Yes.
You know, and that's a very good point you're making. That's a very good point you're making.
What do you think? I'll do a little biblical spin because I know what you taught when you were in Mississippi in the chapel during their devotions. Talk about freedom and the importance of freedom from a government perspective and the biblical root of that idea behind freedom. Because you went into a devotion with them talking about the Exodus and some of the stuff that God did in that. And I thought it was a real great parallel for this conversation. And then I think what we'll do is we'll shift and we'll just go issue by issue and talk about solutions. I think that'd be fun.
All right, great. So I'd like to start with a quote from Little House on the Prairie.
Okay.
Which is a little, I mean, I never read the Little House on the Prairie books as a kid. Did you read them?
I didn't read them.
Did you read them?
No.
No, you see, because we're guys. I quoted this in a couple of churches. And I always ask, who's read the Little House on the Prairie books when they were kids? And almost all the women put their hands up. So I guess, are we allowed to talk about differences between men and women in terms of what books they read? All right, yeah, we're getting into dangerous territory. But my youngest daughter, who's now 12 years old, my youngest daughter, when she was really little, my wife decided that instead of just reading random goodnight stories, we'll take a series of books. And each night before bed, her goodnight story will be a chapter in the book. Excuse me. And we'll go through the whole series. And usually my wife would read to her. And occasionally I would be on reading, goodnight reading duty. So I ended up during this period of time where we were reading her the Little House on the Prairie books, I've read just occasional chapters of Little House on the Prairie. I kind of would come in and out. So one of the chapters that I was reading, there was one of the Little House on the Prairie books, it's called The Long Winter. And there's a scene in there where Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, she's a little girl and she's with her family and they're celebrating July 4th. So this is like in the 1800s and it's in South Dakota. And they go to town, to the town of DeSmet, South Dakota, which is right near their homestead. And in the public square, they did a reading of the Declaration of Independence, which apparently used to be done in public on July 4th. I think it should be brought back. That would be a nice custom. You should.
Live Youngstown Studio.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
A public reading of the Declaration of Independence. And they sang a song. And the song they sang is a song called something like America, God's Land of Liberty. I don't remember the exact name of it. You could look, but it was a song that before the Star-Spangled Banner was the national anthem, was declared the national anthem. It was kind of the unofficial national anthem.
Interesting.
Okay, you can look it up. And one of the lyrics of the song talks about it refers to God as author of liberty. Okay, so in the book, they're in the town square, and Laura has just and they've just finished the ceremony where they read the Declaration of Independence and they sang this song. And this is the passage in the book. The crowd was scattering away, but Laura stood stock still. Suddenly, she had a completely new thought. The declaration and the song came together in her mind. And she thought, God is America's king. She thought, Americans won't obey any king on earth. Americans are free. That means they have to obey their own consciences. No king bosses Pa. He has to boss himself. Why, she thought, when I'm a little older, Pa and Ma will stop telling me what to do, and there isn't anyone else who has a right to give me orders. I will have to make myself be good. Her whole mind seemed to be lit up by this thought. This is what it means to be free. It means you have to be good. Quote, our Father's God, author of liberty. That's a lyric from the song. The laws of nature and of nature's God endow you with a right to life and liberty. Then you have to keep the laws of God. For God's law is the only thing that gives you a right to be free. Now, this is like, I read this. I'm like, my daughter at the time was like 4 years old or something. And I'm reading her a goodnight story. And I read this and I'm like, this is actually a pretty complex piece of theology.
Yeah.
You know, what was written here. This is like Laura Ingalls Wilder, the theology of being American. Yeah. Right? Like, right? It's a really beautiful quote. But let's unpack it for a second. What she's saying is that having faith in God, like an essential aspect of having faith in God, is that I am not bound by any human authority. Ultimately, I mean, there's human authority, and that's what democracy is all about. It's government of the people, by the people, and we elect people. But we're not we have no king. We have no ruler who rules over us. By the way, this song that was the unofficial national anthem, when Americans would sing it, they would sing it to the tune of God Save the Queen, which is just like, which is just incredible. It's just, just beautiful. Because after I read this, I looked up the song, and there's a Wikipedia page about this song. And it says like that it was the national anthem. And then it was this one line that, oh, it's sung to the tune of God Save the Queen. I'm like, wait a second. That's beautiful.
We love our little.
No, but it's also like, exactly. It's so American. Like, you know, like God is the author of my liberty, Queen, you know, like, I thought it was beautiful. But when I read this, I also said to myself, wait a second. This is actually the opening line of the Ten Commandments. The opening line of the Ten Commandments is, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Now here, I'm going to play rabbi for a second. Whenever the Bible has a phrase or a word that is kind of unnecessary, it's repetitive, that's where you have to mark the spot with an X and dig. That's where the gold is. Now, if you're reading the Bible, if this is Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, like you're reading the book of Exodus, you know that Egypt is the place where the people of Israel were enslaved. It doesn't have to add in that phrase from the house of bondage. And what that's saying is that's the way the Bible tells you what to focus on. There was no bold or italics in the Bible. So something would get repeated or kind of expanded in a sentence. And that's the key point. So the key point, in other words, God could have introduced himself by saying, you know, this is the Ten Commandments. God's speaking to the people of Israel. He's introducing himself. The preamble to these Ten Commandments, right? He could say, I am the Lord your God who created heaven and earth. I am the Lord your God, God of your forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, I'm assuming he had a deep resonant voice.
Yeah, I was going to say that. You know, your impression is...
Yeah, I don't know.
Probably a British accent.
Yeah, but don't the villains all have British accents?
Yeah.
I'm thinking more of like, a Southern drawl. You know, like
Southern drawl.
I'm the Lord. but think of how God introduces himself. This is the covenant at Sinai. God introduces himself. He defines himself in that as we're entering the covenant as, I am the Lord your God who set you free from human bondage. Having a covenant with me, being in a relationship with me, in a covenantal relationship with me means, it's built upon the concept that you are free. You are free of human bondage. That's what that means. So, you know, even in our rabbinic literature, people are like, well, first we were slaves to Pharaoh, now we're slaves to God. Like, what's the difference? But Laura Ingalls Wilder zeroes in on the difference. That's the difference. The difference is that when you worship God, when you are subservient, like, I don't want to be subservient. Yeah, but when you're subservient to God, it's a choice you make. And when you're subservient to God, you're empowered. When you're subservient to humans, you're not empowered. When you're subservient to humans, you're afraid. You're limited. When you're subservient to God, you're empowered and you're free. That's what she's describing in that. It's actually a brilliant piece of theology embedded in this children's
literature,
book. The children's literature, which isn't meant to be, it's not viewed as faith literature in any way. But just right there, I mean, I haven't read the rest of the books, but I can't imagine there's a better page in the set of books than that page.
It's, you zeroed in it. That
I mean,
day,
look, that's why it's on my phone. I didn't come here tonight to talk about this book. I keep it on my phone. Wow. I keep that quote on my phone. I find it so powerful.
And that's the premise that goes through and just bleeds on every page of the Constitution. All of that is keeping a people free, so that they can govern themselves.
Yeah, but faith has to be a part of that freedom.
Yeah, you see, I mean, James Madison said that without a moral people, this Constitution isn't meant for a non-moral.
It doesn't work.
People, so it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It just becomes chaos.
Yeah.
In other words, freedom without some, like she calls it, nature's law, God's law, whatever. She uses that term, nature's law,
yeah,
right?
Natural
Which
law,
is
yeah.
referring to God. You know, without some concept of a higher objective good and evil, a higher law, God's law, then human autonomy is just chaos. And then which ends up becoming might makes right, which yeah. ends up becoming oppression. Meaning there's no escaping it.
Yeah.
All right. So, well, today we
and that's why libertarianism is libertarianism is a wonderful concept, but as far as I'm concerned, it's pie in the sky. And can never be implemented. Okay. And that's why the libertarians will never be in power. They'll always be on the sidelines saying, ideally, we should be libertarian. It's like very, very nice. Doesn't work.
I have my own flavor of it.
Okay.
Right?
I see that. I see yeah. that. Okay.
So it's not anarchy, like balanced, right? Just a little version. But if today's culture, we still have a lot of faith that's sort of like we still have that influence, but it's waning. Like every year that goes by, there's less of that influence. So there isn't anything that's teaching the next generation how to be a moral good without having like a social consequence or whatever. So how many generations are we, still going to have some of that influence before there's not a reason to be good?
And this is a good point, and I'll use an Old Testament passage. So there comes the moment where they're going to go into the land of Israel, right? And you have, I think it's in Joshua 3 or whatever, they get ready to cross in for the first time. And Joshua sends the second round of spies in. And they go in, they check the land out, and they have this exchange, and they say something along the lines, and I'm misquote this, but they say something along the lines of, we were disheartened when we heard that you were going to come in. And the things that
the people in Canaan, the Canaanites say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they reference things 40 years ago. And I've preached it this way, that when they had heard that God was going to send them in, they had already lost heart. And so Joshua goes in and clears the land and Jericho and Ai and all the stories. And you get to the end of Joshua, and he has that, the powerful phrase that a lot of Christians have in their kitchen, as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. And that declaration at the end of his life. Then you fast forward to Judges 2, and it says that there arose a generation that had not heard what God had done. They had forgotten everything. I'm not quoting that exactly, but they had forgotten everything that had done. And there's this whole generation rose up that wasn't around. They didn't cross they didn't cross into the promised land. They didn't know any of this stuff. And so, and then you have the period of the judges, which is a dark period in history. I mean, the repeated phrase in the book of Judges is Israel in that day had no king and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And so you have these,
Devolving
into chaos.
Is that due? I mean, is that an inevitability?
But that follows that trend. When you forget where you've come from, is the point I'm making. You devolve into that chaos. And we have a generation right now that, if we're not careful, you have a generation or two, and then you'll devolve into that forgets.
Well, give me the not careful. Like, what's going to stop it from going to chaos?
The answer is right there in the Bible. And there was something that all of those years, there was something very critical that they were told in Deuteronomy that they were supposed to do upon entering the land that they hadn't done yet, and they didn't do for hundreds of years. In Deuteronomy, repeatedly, Moses tells the people that when you go into the land, there is supposed to be one place that God will show you where you're supposed to build a temple, and that will be the house of God. And over again, he tells them there can only be one place. You have to have one place. Now, what does that mean? Why does it have to be one place? How come there can't be temples all over the place? What's wrong with a bunch of temples with a bunch of different altars and different places to bring offerings? Well, there has to be something that unites and centralizes a people. There has to be some glue that holds the collective together. But the Bible's very libertarian. The Bible's very, like, the governance of the people of Israel as it's laid out in the Bible is very... everyone's a landowner. Think about that in the Bible. Everyone's a landowner. So much so that if you fall on hard times and you end up blowing everything because you're lazy or you're an idiot in terms of your investments and you have to sell your land, Jubilee comes, you get it back. You're always potentially a landowner. Everyone's a landowner. There's a lot of human autonomy that is right there in the Bible. The king, kings in the ancient world were all powerful, right? Right there in Deuteronomy, there's rules for the king. The king can be brought up on charges. The king, there's restrictions on what he can do. The limitation on a king's power, which to us, it's like, I don't even want to live under a king. The concept in the ancient Near East of limitations on a king's power is unheard of. And the king has to be, and the people have to decide they want a king. There's no imposition of a king. Yeah. It waits until the people decide they want to have a king. So there's a lot of that going on. But the people of Israel, from when they entered the land, throughout the period of the judges, had not yet built a temple. And because they hadn't yet built a temple, there was no unifying center. There was no capital. There was no unifying center where the people could have a shared identity. Because with a temple in biblical law, there's also the pilgrimage festivals, which means there's a focus on it. That once a year, people make a trek, they make a journey, they go on vacation to the city of Jerusalem, they bring their families, and there's a sense of national unity and national identity. There was no unifying force during the period of the judges. So it devolved into chaos.
Well, and then the correlation being the way our education system and some of these other things are ripping that fabric out. You know, we can't be proud on 4th of July to sing the national anthem and all of these things. You know, that I was very much enjoying some of the woke athletes losing in the Olympics.
Oh.
And I felt horrible.
Oh, for sure. Oh, I've been rooting against them.
I felt horrible
when the women's soccer team lost. I was like, yes.
Now there were a few that stood, but for the rest of them,
lose. Now, but it's not going to be so funny when the U.S. Navy loses in the South China Sea. That's right. Going to be a little serious, you know, because they're also gone woke. But
yeah,
I'm not rooting against them.
Yeah. But I think that's what the parallel is. We don't have anything that centralizes and pulls in that national unity. Everything has been stripped away. And I think that's part of every red-blooded American is feeling that right now. It's what's making strange bedfellows out of, you know, the, you know, traditional liberals and neocons and MAGA people are all going, well, yeah, but we're Americans. Like, yeah, you might think we need a little more regulation there. I might disagree there, but we're Americans. Like I don't, and then we have these fringe groups that are very much anti-American, and it's unreal to me that we keep ceding ground and power to that side.
That was very well put. I mean, you know, you asked me before about my trip, and I've been to all these states, and I don't just go through as a tourist, kind of like going through and visiting landmarks like Elvis's birthplace and taking pictures, because I
trying out his outfit.
No, because I visit churches and I develop relationships with people and I spend time in communities. And someone asked me the other day, so, you know, you've been on these trips, and the previous trip I was on, I went to Minnesota and Wisconsin and Indiana and Ohio. And I did that, this whole section of the country. And previous trip, I was in Oklahoma for a while. Mm-hmm. I've been all over the place. And someone said to me recently, so what do you, what are you sensing in America these days? And I just said, anxiety.
Yeah.
There's a lot of anxiety that's everywhere. There's this sense of like, you know, uncertainty and lack of confidence and fear. And that's not American. That's not America. Right. You know, America was founded on people who just weren't afraid. And that's, you know, the whole stereotype of the brash American is not afraid of anything. That is a stereotype, but it's also coming from a very positive place. Yeah. That Americans kind of like, I fear God and I don't fear anything else.
Yeah.
And our literature and our movies and our TV used to underscore those morals of the, you know, the brave person.
Yeah.
And today's literature and movies and whatever.
We redefine bravery. Ben Shapiro just did a whole podcast on this. He spent a whole segment talking about Simone Biles. And he was like, I have no problem with her stepping out and saying, hey, I'm not going to do my best. Let somebody else step in. No problem. But the issue he took with it is the way the media and everybody turned her into a hero. And he goes, no, a hero is someone who faces something like that and overcomes it.
Who overcomes.
And,
right.
And he talked about Michael Jordan in the flu game. He's like, what made him a hero was he played with a 100-plus degree fever and he won. That's why we remember that game. That's why we call it the flu game. And he made several great points. And he said, redefining bravery. He's like, I don't have a problem with her sitting out. And I don't think she's, you know, an awful person for sitting out or anything like that, but she's not brave. Like that's the total wrong definition, wrong message to send. And it's a redefining of that term. And so much of what we do is in redefinition of terms. The media, the politicians, everybody wants to redefine terms. I mean, Mother's Day this year, they were talking about birthing persons and trying to redefine that term. And that's absolutely disgusting. Like, when you look at that, what you're doing with language, you're trying to create a culture where we can't even communicate. And so we can't have Joe and I can't sit down and have a discussion because we don't agree on the terms. And then if we try and agree on the terms and you won't agree on the terms, we can't even have a disagreement at that point.
Even his passage from Little House on the Prairie, if it was written today, right, he wouldn't be able to illustrate and, you know, highlight the patriotism and whatever.
Exactly.
It'd have to be brought to a level that wouldn't offend somebody who's not patriotic.
Yeah, I just think we should offend people. It's healthy.
It's the best. I think that's what we need more of.
Well, let's do this.
I'm all for it. I'm all for offending.
Let's offend a bunch of people. This is going to be great. So we have 15, 20 minutes or so. And let's just go issue by issue and give us this is how we solve it. Let's take
this. We're
going to
solve it?
How about just like, this is why we're irritated by
it? Yeah. Okay.
But 4 hours late.
I always have a rule. If I'm going to complain about something, I have to offer a solution for it. I tell.
Right. Wow, you're such a positive person, Doug.
Team regular. So
you don't live in the Middle East. In the Middle East, we don't offer solutions.
Well, I just think that
No. We don't have solutions are for dreamers. That's what Americans do. You offer solutions. No. Come to the Middle East. It's not about solutions. It's about living with problems.
Yeah. In a bad neighborhood.
Sorry, dark.
Digress. But I do think, and I am hopeful, and I do think that, and I'm believing that this next generation can be the ones to solve some of these issues. Now, I understand we could get into the political reasons why some of these things don't happen, but I really think some of these issues have really straightforward solutions. Now, people may not have the political gumption to do it. I think one of the reasons, for instance, we had so much success in the Middle East, particularly Israel under the Trump administration, because he finally had the cojones to do some things that everybody else kept kicking the can down the road, from moving the capital to Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, the Abraham Accord. I mean, I could go down the list of things that he chose to do, and it stabilized the region in a way that it hadn't been. It brought Arab partners into Israel, just so many pieces of that. And it took somebody brash like Donald Trump who said, I'm going to have the gumption.
Interesting. You mentioned brash and you say he had the cojones. Because having the cojones, you imply that it's an act of courage, what he did. I think it's actually, you know, to be more precise, and this relates to what you're saying about blowing up the system. What he actually did was he said, I'm not going to accept the prevailing wisdom.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to accept the prevailing wisdom, which is embodied by, you know, John Kerry, who said,
John Kerry.
This quote from John Kerry, at least in Israeli circles, was a viral moment during the last year and a half of the Trump administration, when peace was breaking out all over the Middle East, and we forged official alliances with countries, in the Gulf states and
United Arab Emirates, Bahrain,
Morocco, it's.
And what everybody said was impossible.
Right. But they didn't just say it was impossible. They said it kind of as like the official policy position of the world, of the West, is there cannot be any progress. And John Kerry said this emphatically, but he's just an avatar. I mean, this is the position. The position was you cannot solve the problem of Israel's relationship to other Arab states until you solve the problem of the Palestinians. And Donald Trump was like, no. Now, cynical people will say, well, of course, fine. So Israel has a peace treaty with the United Arab Emirates, which there's multiple countries that separate Israel and the Emirates. Same thing with Morocco. They're on the western end of northern Africa. But that's exactly the point.
Yeah.
Donald Trump thinks like a businessman. And he's like, let's start with the low-hanging fruit. Meaning, you want to get your product out. So what do? You start with the easy sells. And you make a few of those. You get those first customers who are the easy customers to get. And there, from there, you build up a center of gravity for, you already have. That's how he thought about it. He did not approach it he simply rejected the axioms
yeah.
that had governed this whole situation in the Middle East. And voila, it changed. And by the way, unlike some other things, like, let's say, pulling out of the Iran deal, and now the Biden administration wants to get back into it, and they're falling all over themselves because Iran is misbehaving. So they want to, it's like they want to make peace with Iran, but Iran's misbehaving, so they can't make peace with Iran. It's kind of, I find it like, if it wasn't so serious, it would be hilarious
yeah.
what's going on there. But there are there are policies that when the new administration comes in, they can just undo them.
Yeah.
These peace deals that Trump made have a life of their own.
Yeah.
Like there is now business cooperation. I have friends who run companies in the high tech sector in Israel who are involved now with Emirati investors who are setting up investment, capital investment offices in Tel Aviv so that they can work with Israeli wow. tech companies. And these things are happening.
It's a game changer.
It's a game changer. And it's going to be a game changer. And there's nothing that a new administration can do about it. These yeah. peace deals, you know, they enabled things that are ongoing now.
Wow.
So, you know, but so when you talk about solutions,
yeah.
it's not just about having courage. It's yeah. also about saying, I'm simply not going to accept the prevailing wisdom.
So let's not accept the prevailing wisdom. And let's hit the topics here and just how do we solve them? So let's start with the border crisis. Immigration right now slowed under the Trump administration. It's been abysmal and just a porous border. Are you, being a libertarian, are you open borders?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Not I didn't think so.
No.
But I had to ask that because I know some libertarians that are like, borders don't mean anything. Let's just do whatever we want. What's the answer to the border crisis? Obviously, it's both humanitarian and the concern of a nation state having borders and walls and laws and those sort of things. So
it's also economical.
And it's also economical. So how do we solve it? Let's throw out the axioms and everything else.
I think you have to have a rule set that parses out what your intention is with it. I mean, we should be a huge recruiter of talent and specialties sure. and educations and whatever. And if we're taking people in as a humanitarian thing, we got to put it in the humanitarian basket so it's treated differently than, you know, those other things. I think we should be, you know, I don't necessarily think you change the number of people, but you treat each group that you bring in for different purposes.
From the beginning, though, do we have a principle that if you're here illegally, you have to go? I mean, that was Trump's big thing. I mean, that's what sent him into the...
And that's the hang-up of figuring out what mistakes you do with the mistakes of yesterday instead of, like, starting today and saying, okay, well, we screwed up, whatever.
Meaning there's multiple questions in this question.
Correct. Yes.
There's multiple questions in the question. I think that one question that we have to ask ourselves, look, we have no power, the three of us. So we're actually kind of observers of the situation. I think that one question we have to ask ourselves is, to what extent is the border crisis something that the Biden administration actually deliberately invited?
Mm.
And I'm not saying that as like a conspiracy theorist or like, I'm saying that like they canceled the continuing construction of a wall where contracts were already signed and paid for, and they're losing billions of dollars.
Yeah.
That was already earmarked for building this, and they deliberately wanted it to stop.
So as an Israeli, do walls work?
Walls work. They work very well. And listen, I was down 2 months ago. I was down in Laredo, in Zapata. I spoke in a church on the border in Laredo. Wow. I have friends in Corpus Christi. I visited that area of the country, and I spoke to people down there. And all of them, and we're talking 90% of the people I'm talking to are Latinos who live along the border. And they all want that wall finished. Mm. I mean, there is a myth, and it's absolutely false, that Latinos
yeah.
want to be soft on immigration on the border. It's just the opposite. The Latinos who live down there are generally working class. People streaming across the border, these are not highly educated people streaming across the border. The people whose jobs they will take
yeah.
are the working class who live
on the border,
in those communities. Yeah, exactly. That's who's hurt by this. And you have to ask yourself, like, why is this happening? Meaning, you don't have to go into conspiracy theory area to say, wait a second, what was gained by the people in power to roll back those particular policies that Trump had? What were they trying to accomplish in this? Because, you know, there's a pandemic going on, unemployment, you know, right. Couldn't you just say, listen, for humanitarian reasons, we want to take people in, but we need to stabilize some things in this country first.
Yeah.
Before we're in a position to do so, like, and that didn't
not
happen.
COVID testing anybody coming
around. No, it's
a mess.
Yeah, so I think that's of all the policy choices that this administration made, I think that's the one that's most sinister.
Do you find logic in it? I mean, is it?
Yeah, I don't. I'm not. Well, it's hard for me to find logic in it without getting really sinister and sounding like a conspiracy theorist, right. Because you wonder to yourself, like really, like I could understand saying like. Increasing government spending or even all the woke stuff and the Green New Deal. That's coming from an ideological place. I disagree with that ideology, but I understand. I have progressive friends. I understand what that ideology is and how these things fulfill that ideology. I do not understand how throwing open the borders fulfills the progressive ideology. Mm. Like, what does it do? And it really does cause a lot of destruction for the United States. They're also, I think the worst part of it we haven't mentioned is that this isn't migrants who are using just their own human agency and packing up their families and walking across. Everyone who crosses the border, single person who crosses the border only does so if they paid the appropriate amount of money and are in the hands of the cartels and are being handed over to other. And then when they come across the border and they have a phone number and a name in their pocket of a friend or family member that they're going to, that's another cartel member that they're being handed off to. This is human trafficking. By throwing open the border, the United States government is enabling a massive amount of human trafficking. And the cartels are very powerful down there. I was talking to a pastor, a friend of mine, who pastors a church in Laredo, Texas. Now, Laredo, if you know anything about the Texas border, Laredo literally sits on the border, meaning there's Laredo, Texas, and on the other side of the border, there's Nuevo Laredo, which is a Mexican town. And if you look at them in an aerial photo, it's one city. Like, the border runs through Laredo. Okay, and this is we're talking, when we say border town, border town. Everyone down there is Latino. And, you know, I was talking to him about, you know, dealing with, you know, the cartels and what goes on in Nuevo Laredo. He says, Nuevo Laredo is a cartel town. There's no Mexican police force in Nuevo Laredo. They're not allowed in. It's run by the cartels. The cartels run these border towns. Wow. And they are armed and they are dangerous and they're making billions of dollars in this massive human trafficking. And anyone who wants to cross the border from any of those migrants must go through. You can't cross the border without going through the cartels. All these numbers of migrants, look at every single one of them and say, you know, it's thousands of dollars. Every single one of them paid thousands of dollars to the cartels that they saved up years for or borrowed and are hoping when they get to the golden land of America and they start working, they're going to be for years paying back that money to the cartels. And a lot of the cartel guys live in the States. They live on this side of the border. Why would they want to live in Mexico? So they have homes in, you know, all along the border. And the pastor was telling me that on the American side of Laredo, there's a whole neighborhood, which is all cartel members. Everyone knows it.
That's crazy.
These guys are powerful.
Wow.
And the Mexican government is powerless to do anything about it because the cartels are more powerful than them. What I honestly think that if I was in charge, this is going to sound radical to people only because no one's mentioned it, but I really think that what the United States of America should do is basically invade. You can even tell the Mexican government, look, you're not cleaning this up. We're going to clean it up. I'm all for immigration, but this is human trafficking. The amount of rape and the amount of trafficking in children that is going on in this whole border thing. So I think talking about the numbers of immigrants it sidesteps the bigger issue that this is a human trafficking operation that's being enabled.
Well, I always find it interesting. I don't feel.
You see, I'm not offering solutions. I'm just talking about what irritates me.
But
I think it's a human rights crisis.
Well, in some way, I think you are, because, you know, in Israel, the military, for the most part, runs the borders because you guys are not in a great neighborhood. And I know that solution, everybody, I think it was kicked around on some conservative blogs and stuff like that during the Trump administration. But, you know, you think about that in terms of who's better than the U.S. military.
Why isn't – I'm telling you, as an Israeli, I'm like
– Yeah.
I don't understand why they just deploy the military, line the border, wherever there's no wall, have soldiers.
And what are you going to do? Yeah.
Like,
So, but when that narrative is framed, it's not what you said. It's that this is a humanitarian thing where these people are escaping oppression and whatever. So who lets that narrative pass muster without the truth be told about it? Like who's behind it? It seems like, why isn't it being challenged more?
Well, this I think goes into something I said earlier, where we have this marriage of the corporate elites and the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party
and the mainstream media.
And the mainstream media. The Democratic Party gains from immigrants coming in. And that's why it's not just that, oh, they're illegal immigrants. They're illegal immigrants and they want to grant them amnesty. They want to get them on a quick road to citizenship.
Like government programs or voting blocks? Like what?
Meaning they become citizens. These are going to be poor people. These are going to be low-end working class people. And therefore, they're going to be, at least for quite a number of years, very amenable to voting for a party that's going to give more government handouts. So it increases the voting block of the Democratic Party. I think also cheap labor, driving down the cost of labor, lower wages. We're talking before about, you know, Trump working to raise the wages of the working class. Lower wages, who does that benefit? Benefits corporations. They have no incentive. Why do they want, you know, if there's a bigger labor market, wages go down. Wages go down, corporations benefit. I think there are people who benefit from this. Hmm. You know, again, this is starting to sound sinister. I don't understand it. But look, when Biden was running for president, when he was in the Democratic primaries, there's a famous clip of him saying that if he becomes president, he's going to throw open the border. Wow. He came right out and said it. So now when we have Kamala Harris going down there and saying, don't come up here, I think that's all just a dog and pony show. I think they're perfectly happy bringing in these people.
Well, because they have the ability to re-implement those things and continue building the wall. I mean,
are we going to get canceled from YouTube for this conversation? Probably. Has that happened to you before?
No, okay. We've been pretty good. Okay. Yeah. We use code words.
Is this the last time I'm on this show? Is this it?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all.
Good.
Let's do COVID's another hot button issue. So let's talk COVID a little bit, and then we're going to be.
Well, COVID really gets you canceled if you say the wrong thing. So
yeah, so that's what we're going for, Joe. We're gonna take a swing for this.
Might as well. Let's go out
because we talked about COVID during COVID.
Yeah,
we told them it sucked. So, so in the arena of COVID, obviously Israel's been instrumental in the development of the vaccines. Has been huge in pushing the vaccines
ahead of everyone. Yeah,
and it's been. It's very interesting if you look at the demographic breakdowns in the United States of those who've gotten vaccinated and those who haven't. It's been very interesting to see the hesitation. I think a lot of that has to do with messaging from the administration. But the various variants now, the Delta variant, they're talking about some Lambda variant and something else.
It's a big Greek alphabet.
Yeah, exactly. Is there ever an end to this is my first question. Do we ever stop hearing about the next variant, the next thing? Because they were able to control the population so well, and we willingly closed our businesses.
Well, because when we're told 15 days to slow the spread and to flatten the curve, I think everyone was willing to go along with that. But look, I live in Israel, and we had some serious lockdowns.
You guys did.
But then it looked like with the vaccination rollout, it looked like we had conquered it. But now things are spiking. I don't know if you're noticing the news out of Israel. Mm-hmm. COVID's spiking there again. It appears that the vaccine has a 6-month shelf life in our bodies.
Which is interesting because it's
an experimental vaccine.
Right. Like, my family doctor, though, so I had COVID. And I'm still testing off the charts for the antibodies.
Right. I think that might be. I mean, this is going to get this video pulled down. But I think, one thing that we're not hearing any conversation about in the media, when everyone talks about herd immunity and everyone talks about getting to that number, is the messaging is all how many people are vaccinated.
Right.
Well, what about all the people who have the antibodies?
Right.
Meaning, like you.
What do I need to get the vaccine for? Like.
Well, it's even more than that.
Yeah.
That vaccine is better used on someone.
Yeah.
Who wasn't sick and so I don't know. Like, is there any end to it? I don't know if there's any. I mean,
which it's just fascinating because you watch all the governments throughout the world, and in America, it was very much left, right, left wanted to close things down, right wanted to open things up.
But in Israel
it was the total opposite.
In Israel was the opposite, right?
Which is fascinating.
Well, it's actually pretty shallow and simple, which is
okay.
Whoever was in charge,
yeah,
and whatever they were messaging. So you know, so Netanyahu was right wing, but he was very pro vaccine and very into the lockdowns, even though he's a right wing nationalist populist. So the left wing in Israel was against the lockdowns and against and anti-vaccine. Like, you know, it's just the politicization of this thing. It was, that's the way it worked. But now in Israel, there's a lot of there's like, and when I say now, I mean like now, like this week, last week. I don't know. I've been away and I've just been watching the news from Israel, and people are starting to scratch their heads and like, okay, wait a second. This vaccine is kind of like not protecting us anymore. And what does this mean? We're gonna be shooting up on this thing every 6 months,
yeah,
forever and ever and ever. And I think one thing to watch for also is, media always reports cases. Mm-hmm. Can we stop reporting cases,
yeah,
and start reporting deaths?
Yep.
Because if people are getting sick and not, and then recovering,
who cares?
Is that a pandemic?
Yep.
Is that something I should, like, fine, like, human, there's all kinds of diseases that, yeah, you know, they're out there. You get sick, you take something.
Abraham had influenza A and influenza B 3 months apart. Like, he was fine. He recovered.
Whatever. No, but that's fine. It's bad. No one wants to be sick.
Right.
But like, why should anyone lose their job or not be able to travel somewhere because you know, there's a flu going around that people are not dying from at a high rate.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I got double vaxxed early on, like most people in Israel, and I'm thankful for it because for a while we had a good thing going. I don't know what the future holds, but yeah.
Joe, will you shut down again? I'm totally putting you on the spot.
Would I shut things down again? If it's necessary. Like, again, like, if...
What does necessary mean?
If our hospitals start burgeoning and they can't keep up with cases...
Yeah, but does closing business actually reduce the cases?
And so I'm going to reserve it that if it's a necessary tool that actually is effective, then yes. Whether or not it be... You know, I don't think across the board national...
Yeah, but don't you want to see legitimate data that would support...
Yeah.
I do.
That the lockdown works.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and this is the.
But I want people to have the tool to be able to respond to it. That if there is something, that there's something in the arsenal.
So this is the whole thing. So for me, as pastor, as I watch this, so we played ball. We closed down. I think it ended up being 10 weeks or something like that, and then we reopened. None of our people here. They all came back hugging, kissing each other, sitting wherever they wanted to sit. It didn't matter that we.
Did you have people die from COVID?
We did not, thank God. We had some people had extended family members, but nobody directly. In the member of the congregation or anything like that. We had one person that was pretty sick and ended up in the hospital, but recovered. But the one thing I noticed was when we had spikes in cases in the area, so that end of November, beginning December here, it burned through, a whole bunch of people got sick. Attendance dropped. People kept themselves home because they did that. More people wore masks. Like, people are not stupid.
And humans, I think, are rational.
That's the whole thing. It's sure. Like, all right, a lot
give
of people
you information,
are
let you choose. Right.
Exactly. That, to me, is the approach I would hope that the government...
You know, if there was a stomach bug going around, and they heard that in your church a whole bunch of people had a stomach bug,
right,
they would have stayed home, too.
Yep. People keep their kids home because, it's running through the nursery.
It's sort of like a tornado warning. Like, you tell the county where the tornado is, and...
Exactly. And then people make their decisions.
Right. Go on your porch and look at it,
right,
or go on your shelter. Right.
Take a video.
Or you know... If you're a little nuts or you're desperate, so you'll go to 7-Eleven and buy something, even though there's a tornado going
right
on, and you know,
shorter
whatever
lines, of course.
Yeah, shorter lines. Well, we did not solve any of the
zero. No, no.
We actually made it through one and a half, and the half that we did is probably going to get the video throttled. So, Lucas, good luck.
So, those of you who watched live, I hope you enjoyed it.
We so appreciate you being with us, Rabbi. This was a ton of fun. We need to do another one of these and tackle some more issues.
All right.
We haven't done a political show in a while. So,
I'll be back.
Yeah, you'll definitely be back. And Joe, this was fun. Welcome home.
Thank you.
And we'll see you guys back here on Tuesday.
Thank you for listening to this show on Youngstown Studio. If you like our programming, we invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow our Facebook page, or subscribe to your favorite podcast platform like iTunes or Spotify. This is original Youngstown content, and we would appreciate you sharing the videos and the word about us. Thank you.